You're listening to General Abstract Nonsense on WMBR Cambridge 88.1 FM. Now, a story from Carl Ove Knausgård. For the heart, life is simple. It beats for as long as it can. Then it stops. Sooner or later, one day, this pounding action will cease of its own accord, and the blood will begin to run towards the body's lowest point, where it will collect in a small pond, visible from outside as a dark, soft patch on ever-whitening skin. As the temperature sinks, the limbs stiffen, and the intestines drain. These changes in the first hours occur so slowly, and take place with such inexorability, that there is something almost ritualistic about them, as though life capitulates according to specific rules, a kind of gentleman's agreement to which the representatives of death also adhere, inasmuch as they always wait until life has retreated before they launch their invasion of the new landscape, by which point, however, the invasion is irrevocable. The enormous hordes of bacteria that begin to infiltrate the body's innards cannot be halted. Had they but tried a few hours earlier, they would have met with immediate resistance. However, everything around them is quiet now, as they delve deeper and deeper into the moist darkness. They advance on the Havers channels, the crypts of Lieber Kuhn, the Isles of Langerhans. They proceed to Bowman's capsule in the Rhenes, Clark's column in the Spinalis, the black substance in the Mesocephalon, and they arrive at the heart. As yet, it is intact, but deprived of the activity to which end its whole construction has been designed. There is something strangely desolate about it, like a production plant that workers have been forced to flee in haste. Or, so it appears, the stationary vehicle is shining yellow against the darkness of the forest. The hut's deserted, a line of fully loaded cable buckets stretching up the hillside. The moment life departs the body, it belongs to death. At one with lamps, suitcases, carpets, door handles, windows, fields, marshes, streams, mountains, clouds, the sky. None of these is alien to us. We are constantly surrounded by objects and phenomena from the realm of death. Nonetheless, there are a few things that arouse in us greater distaste than to see a human being caught up in it, at least if we are to judge by the efforts we make to keep corpses out of sight. In larger hospitals, they are not only hidden away in discreet, inaccessible rooms, even the pathways there are concealed with their own elevators and basement corridors, and should you stumble upon one of them, the dead bodies being wheeled away are always covered. When they have to be transported from the hospital, it is through a designated exit into vehicles with tinted glass. In the church grounds, there is a separate windowless room for them. During the funeral ceremony, they lie in closed coffins until they are lowered into the earth or cremated in the oven. It is hard to imagine what practical purpose this procedure might serve. The uncovered bodies could be wheeled along the hospital corridors, for example, and thence be transported in an ordinary taxi without this posing a particular risk to anyone. The elderly man who dies during a cinema performance might just as well remain in his seat until the film is over, and during the next two, for that matter. The teacher who has a heart attack in the school playground does not necessarily have to be driven away immediately. No damage is done by leaving him where he is until the caretaker has time to attend to him, even though that might not be until sometime in the late afternoon or evening. What difference would it make if a bird were to alight on him and take a peck? Would what awaits him in the grave be any better just because it is hidden? As long as the dead are not in the way, there is no need for any rush. They cannot die a second time. Cold snaps in the winter should be particularly propitious in such circumstances. The homeless who freeze to death on benches and in doorways, the suicidal who jump off high buildings and bridges, elderly women who fall down staircases, traffic victims trapped in wrecked cars, the young man who, in a drunken stupor, falls into the lake after a night on a town, the small girl who ends up under the wheel of a bus, why all this haste to remove them from the public eye? Decency? What could be more decent than to allow the girl's mother and father to see her, an hour or two later, lying in the snow at the site of the accident, in full view, her crushed head, and the rest of her body, her blood-splattered hair, and the spotless padded jacket. Visible to the whole world, no secrets, the way she was. But even this 1 hour in the snow is unthinkable. A town that does not keep its dead out of sight, that leaves people where they died on highways and byways, in parks and parking lots, is not a town but a hell. The fact that this hell reflects our life experience in a more realistic and essentially truer way is of no consequence. We know this is how it is, but we do not want to face it. Hence the collective act of repression symbolized by the concealment of our dead. What exactly it is that is being repressed, however, is not so easy to say. It cannot be death itself, for its presence in society is much too prominent. The number of deaths reported in newspapers or shown on the TV news every day varies slightly according to circumstances, but the annual average will presumably trend to be constant, and since it is spread over so many channels, virtually impossible to avoid. Yet that kind of death does not seem threatening. Quite the contrary, it is something we are drawn to and will happily pay to see. Add the enormously high body count in fiction, and it becomes even harder to understand the system that keeps death out of sight. If the phenomenon of death does not frighten us, why then this distaste for dead bodies? It must mean either that there are two kinds of death, and that there is a disparity between our conception of death and death as it actually turns out to be, which in effect boils down to the same thing. What is significant here is that our conception of death is so strongly rooted in our consciousness that we are not only shaken when we see that reality deviates from it, but we also try to conceal this within all the means at our disposal. Not as a result of some form of conscious deliberation, as has been the case with funeral rites, the form and meaning of which are negotiable nowadays, and thus have shifted from the sphere of the irrational to the rational, from the collective to the individual. No, the way we remove our bodies has never been the subject of debate. It has always been just something we have done, out of a necessity for which no one can state a reason, but everyone feels. If your father dies on the lawn one windswept Sunday in autumn, you carry him indoors if you can, and if you can't, you at least cover him with a blanket. This impulse, however, is not the only one we have with regard to the dead. No less conspicuous than our hiding the corpses is the fact that we always lower them to ground level as fast as possible. A hospital that transports its bodies upward that cites its cold chambers on the upper floors is practically inconceivable. The dead are stored as close to the ground as possible. And the same principle applies to the agencies that attend them. An insurance company might well have its offices on the 8th floor, but not a funeral parlor. All funeral parlors have their offices as close to street level as possible. Why this should be is hard to say. One might be tempted to believe that it was based on some ancient convention that originally had a practical purpose, such as a cellar being cold and therefore being suited to storing corpses, and that this principle had been retained in our era of refrigerators and cold storage rooms. Had it not been for the notion that transporting bodies upward in buildings seems contrary to the laws of nature, as though height and death are mutually incompatible, as though we possessed some sort of chthonic instinct, something deep within us that urges us to move death down to the earth once we came. It might thus appear that death is relayed through two distinct systems. One is associated with concealment and gravity, earth and darkness. The other with openness and airiness, ether and light. A father and his child are killed as the father attempts to pull the child out of the line of fire in a town somewhere in the Middle East. And the image of them huddled together as the bullets thud into flesh, causing their bodies to shudder as it were, is caught on camera, transmitted to one of the thousands of satellites orbiting the Earth and broadcast onto television sets around the world, from whence it slips into our consciousness as yet another picture of death or dying. These images have no weight, no depth, no time. And no place, nor do they have any connection to the bodies that spawned them. They are nowhere and everywhere. Most of them just pass through us and are gone. For diverse reasons, some linger and live on in the dark recesses of the brain. An off-piste day skier falls and severs an artery in her thigh. Blood streams out, leaving a red trail down the white slope. She is dead even before her body comes to a halt. A plane takes off, flames shoot out from the engines as it climbs. The sky above the suburban houses is blue, the plane explodes in a ball of fire beneath. A fishing smack sinks off the coast of northern Norway one night. The crew of seven drown. Next morning the event is described in all the newspapers. It is a so-called mystery. The weather was calm and no mayday call was sent from the boat. It just disappeared. A fact which the television stations underlined that evening by flying over the scene of the drama in a helicopter and showing pictures of the empty sea. The sky is overcast. The gray-green swell, heavy but calm, as though possessing a different temperament from the choppy, white-flecked waves that burst forth here and there. I am sitting alone watching. It is sometime in the spring, I suppose, for my father is working in the garden. I stare at the surface of the sea without listening to what the reporter says, and suddenly the outline of a face emerges. I don't know for how long it stays there. A few seconds, perhaps, but long enough for it to have a huge impact on me. The moment the face disappears, I get up to find someone I can tell. My mother is on the evening shift, my brother is playing soccer, and the other children on our block won't listen, so it has to be Dad, I think. and hurry down the stairs, jump into shoes, thread my arms through the sleeves of my jacket, open the door, and run around the house. We are not allowed to run in the garden, so just before I enter his line of vision, I slow down and start walking. He is standing at the rear of the house, down in what will be the vegetable plot, lunging at a boulder with a sledgehammer. Even though the hollow is only a few meters deep, the black soil he has dug up and is standing on, together with the dense clump of rowan trees growing beyond the fence behind him, cause the twilight to deepen. As he straightens up and turns to me, his face is almost completely shrouded in darkness. Nevertheless, I have more than enough information to know his mood. This is apparent not from his facial expressions, but his physical posture, and you do not read it with your mind, but with your intuition. He puts down the sledgehammer and removes his gloves. "Well," he says, "I've just seen a face in the sea on TV," I say, coming to a halt on the lawn above him. The neighbor had felled a pine tree earlier in the evening, and the air is filled with the strong resin smell from the logs lying on the other side of the stone wall. "A diver," Dad says. He knows I am interested in divers, and I suppose he cannot imagine I would find anything else interesting enough to make me come out and tell him about it. I shake my head. "It wasn't a person. It was something I saw in the sea." "Something you saw, eh?" he says, taking the packet of cigarettes from his breast pocket. I nod and turn to go. "Wait a minute," he says. He strikes a match and bends his head forward to light the cigarette. The flame carves out a small grotto of light in the gray dusk. "Right," he says. After taking a deep drag, he places one foot on the rock and stares in the direction of the forest on the other side of the road, or perhaps he is staring at the sky above the trees. "Was it Jesus you saw?" he asks, looking at me. Had it not been for the friendly voice and the long pause before the question, I would have thought he was poking fun at me. He finds it rather embarrassing that I am a Christian. All he wants of me is that I do not stand out from the other kids, and of all the teeming mass of kids on the estate, no one other than his youngest son calls himself a Christian. But he is really giving this some thought. I feel a rush of happiness because he actually cares, while still feeling vaguely offended that he can underestimate me in this way. I shake my head. "It wasn't Jesus," I say. "That's nice to hear," Dad says with a smile. Higher up on the hillside, the faint whistle of bicycle tires on pavement can be heard. The sound grows, and it is so quiet on the estate that the low singing tone at the heart of the whistle resonates loud and clear, and soon afterward the bicycle races past us on the road. Dad takes another drag from the cigarette before tossing it half-smoked over the fence, then coughs a couple of times, pulls on his gloves, and grabs the sledgehammer again. "Don't give it another thought," he says, glancing up at me. I was 8 years old that evening. My father, 32. Even though I still can't say that I understand him or know what kind of person he was, the fact that I am now 7 years older than he was makes it easier for me to grasp some things. For example, how great the difference was between our days. While my days were jam-packed with meaning, when each step opened a new opportunity, and when every opportunity filled me to the brim in a way which now is actually incomprehensible, the meaning of his days was not concentrated in individual events, but spread out over such large areas that it was not possible to comprehend them in anything other than abstract names. Family, was one term, career another. Few or no unforeseen opportunities at all can have prevented themselves. In the course of his days, he must always have known in broad outline what they would bring and how he would react. He had been married for 12 years. He had worked as a middle school teacher for 8 of them. He had 2 children, a house, and a car. He had been elected onto local council and appointed to the executive committee representing the Liberal Party. During the winter months, he occupied himself with philately, not with some progress. Inside a short span of time, he had become one of the country's leading stamp collectors, while in the summer months gardening took up what leisure he had. What he was thinking on this spring evening, I have no idea, nor even what perception he had of himself as he straightened up in the gloom with a sledgehammer in his hands, but I am fairly sure there was some feeling inside him that he understood the surrounding world quite well. He knew who all the neighbors on the estate were, and what social status they held in relation to him. And I imagine he knew quite a bit about what they preferred to keep to themselves, as he taught the children, and also because he had a good eye for others' weaknesses. Being a member of the newly educated middle class, he was also well informed about the wider world, which came to him every day via the newspaper, radio, and television. He knew quite a lot about botany and zoology because he had been interested for a while he was growing up, and though not exactly conversant with other science subjects, he did at least have some command of their basic principles from secondary school. He was better at history, which he had studied at university along with Norwegian and English. In other words, he was not an expert at anything apart from maybe pedagogy, but he knew quite a bit about everything. In this respect, he was a typical schoolteacher, though from a time when secondary school teaching still carried some status. The neighbor who lived on the other side of the wall, Frestbakmo, worked as a teacher at the same school, as did the neighbor who lived on top of the tree-covered slope behind our house, Olsen, while one of the neighbors who lived at the far end of the ring road, Nidsen, was the head teacher of another middle school. So, when my father raised the sledgehammer above his head and let it fall on the rock that spring evening in the mid-1970s, he was doing so in a world he knew and was familiar with. It was not until I myself reached the same age that I understood there was indeed a price to pay for this. As your perspective of the world increases, not only is the pain it inflicts on you less, but also its meaning. Understanding the world requires you to take a certain distance from it. Things that are too small to see with the naked eye, such as molecules and atoms, we magnify. Things that are too large, such as cloud formations, river deltas, constellations, we reduce. At length, we bring it within the scope of our senses, and we stabilize it with fixer. When it has been fixed, we call it knowledge. Throughout our childhood and teenage years, we strive to attain the correct distance to objects and phenomena. We read, we learn, we experience, we make adjustments. Then one day, we reach the point where all the necessary distances have been set, all the necessary systems have been put in place. That is when time begins to pick up speed. It no longer meets any obstacles. Everything is set. Time races through our lives. The days pass by in a flash. And before we know what is happening, we are 40, 50, 60. Meaning requires content. Content requires time. Time requires resistance. Knowledge is distance. Knowledge is stasis and the enemy of meaning. My picture of my father on that evening in 1976 is, in other words, twofold. On the one hand, I see him as I saw him at that time. through the eyes of an 8-year-old, unpredictable and frightening. On the other hand, I see him as a peer through whose life time is blowing and unremittingly sweeping large chunks of meaning along with it. Sledgehammer and rock resounded through the estate. A car came up the gentle slope from the main road and passed, its lights blazing. The door of the neighboring house opened. Presta Bachmo paused on the doorsteps, pulled on his work gloves, and seemed to sniff the clear night air before grabbing the wheelbarrow and trundling it across the lawn. There was a smell of gunpowder from the rock Dad was pounding, of pine from the logs behind the stone wall, freshly dug soil and forest, and in the gentle northerly breeze, a whiff of salt. I thought of the face I had seen in the sea. Even though only a couple of minutes had passed since I last considered it, everything had changed. Now it was Dad's face I saw. Down in the hollow, he took a break from hammering at the rock. "Are you still there, boy?" I nodded. "Get yourself inside." They started to walk. And Carl Ove. "Remember," he said. I paused and turned my head, puzzled. No running this time. I stared at him. How could he have known I had run? "And shut your ma," he said. "You look like an idiot." I did as he said, closed my mouth and walked slowly around the house. Reaching the front, I saw the road was full of children. The oldest stood in a group with their bikes, which in the dusk almost appeared as an extension of their bodies. The youngest were playing kick the can. The ones who had been tagged stood inside a chalk circle on the pavement. The others were hidden at various places in the forest down from the road, out of sight of the person guarding the can, but visible to me. The lights on the bridge masts glowed red above the black treetops. Another car came up the hill. The headlights illuminated the cyclists first, a brief glimpse of reflectors, metal, puffet jackets, black eyes, and white faces, then the children, who had taken no more than one necessary step aside to allow the car to pass, were now standing like ghosts, gawking. It was the Trollnazis, the parents of Sveer, a boy in my class. He didn't seem to be with them. I turned and followed the red taillights until they disappeared over the summit of the hill. Then I went in. For a while I tried to lie on my bed reading, but could not settle and instead went into Yngvi's room, where from I could see Dad. When I could see him, I felt safer with him, and in a way, that was what mattered most. I knew his moods and had learned how to predict them long ago, by means of a kind of subconscious categorization system I have later come to realize, whereby the relationship between a few constants was enough to determine what was in store for me, allowing me to make my own preparations. A kind of meteorology of the mind. The speed of the car up the gentle gradient to the house. The time it took him to switch off the engine, grab his things, and step out. The way he looked around as he locked the car, the subtle nuances of the various sounds that rose from the hall as he removed his coat. Everything was a sign, and everything could be interpreted. To this was added information about where he had been and with whom, how long he had been away, before the conclusion, which was the only part of the process of which I was conscious, was drawn. So what frightened me most was when he turned up without warning, when, for some reason, I had been inattentive. How on earth did he know I had been running? This was not the first time he had caught me out in a way I found incomprehensible. One evening that autumn, for example, I had hidden a bag of sweets under the duvet for the express purpose that I had a hunch he would come into my room, and there was no way he would believe my explanation of how I had laid my hands on the money to buy them. When, sure enough, he did come in, he stood watching me for a few seconds. "What have you got hidden in your bed?" he asked. How could he possibly have known? Outside, Pressbachma switched on the powerful lamp that was mounted over the flagstones where he usually worked. The new island of light that emerged from the blackness displayed a whole array of objects that he stood stock still ogling. Columns of paint cans, jars containing paintbrushes, logs, bits of planking, folded tarps, car tires, a bicycle frame, some toolboxes, tins of screws and nails of all shapes and sizes, a tray of milk cartons with flower seedlings, sacks of lime, a rolled-up horse pipe, and, leaning against the wall, a board on which every conceivable tool was outlined, presumably intended for the hobby room in the cellar. Glancing outside at Dad again, I saw him crossing the lawn with a sledgehammer in one hand and a spade in the other. I took a couple of hasty steps backwards. As I did so, the front door burst open. It was Yngvi. I looked at my watch. 8:28. When, straight afterward, he came up the stairs with the familiar, slightly jerky, almost duck-like gait we developed, so as to be able to walk fast inside the house without making a sound, he was breathless and ruddy-cheeked. "Where's Dad?" he asked as soon as he was in the room. "In the garden. But you're not late. Look, it's 8:30 now." I showed him my watch. He walked past me and pulled the chair from under the desk. He still smelled of the outdoors. Cold air, forest, gravel, pavement. "Have you been messing with my cassettes?" he asked. "No," I answered. "What are you doing in my room, then?" "Nothing," I said. "Can't you do nothing in your own room?" Below us, the front door opened again. This time it was Dad's heavy footsteps traversing the floor downstairs. He had removed the boots outside, as usual, and was on his way to the washroom to change. "I saw a face in the sea on the news tonight," I said. "Have you heard anything about it? Do you know if anyone else saw it?" Yngvi eyed me with a half-curious, half-dismissive expression. "What are you babbling on about? You know the fishing boat that sank?" He gave a barely perceptible nod. When they were showing the place where it sank in the news, I saw a face in the sea. A dead body? No, it wasn't a real face. The sea had formed into the shape of a face. For a moment, he watched me without saying anything. Then, he tapped a forefinger on his temple. "Don't you believe me?" I said. "It's absolutely true." "The truth is, you're a waste of space." At that moment, Dad switched off the tap downstairs, and I decided it was best to go to my room now, so that there was no chance of meeting him on the landing. But I did not want Yngvi to have the last word. "You're the one who's a waste of space," I said. He could not even be bothered to answer. Just turned his face towards me, stuck out his top teeth, and blew air through them like a rabbit. The gesture was a reference to my protruding teeth. I broke away and made off before he could see my tears. As long as I was alone, my crying didn't bother me. And this time it had worked, hadn't it? Because he hadn't seen me. I paused inside the door of my room, and I wondered for a moment whether to go to the bathroom. I could rinse my face with cold water and remove the telltale signs. But Dad was on his way up the stairs, so I made do with wiping my eyes on the sleeve of my sweater, the thin layer of moisture that the dry material spread across my eye made the surfaces and colors of the room blur, as though it had suddenly sunk and was now underwater. And so real was this perception that I raised my arms and made a few swimming strokes as I walked toward the writing desk. In my mind, I was wearing a metal diver's helmet from the early days of diving, when they bestrode the seabed with leaden shoes and suits as thick as elephant skin, with an oxygen pipe attached to their heads like a kind of trunk. I wheezed through my mouth and staggered around for a while with the heavy, sluggish movements of divers from bygone days, until the horror of the sensation slowly began to seep in like cold water. A few months before, I had seen the television series The Mysterious Island, based on Jules Verne's novel, and the story of those men who landed their air balloons on a deserted island in the Atlantic had made an enormous impact on me from the very first moment. Everything was electric. The air balloon, the storm, the men dressed in 19th century clothing, the weather-beaten barren island where they had been marooned, which apparently was not as deserted as they imagined. Mysterious and inexplicable things were always happening around them. But in that case, who were the others? The answer came without warning toward the end of one episode. There was something in the underwater caves, a number of humanoid creatures. In the light from the lamps they were carrying, they saw glimpses of smooth masked heads, fins. They resembled a kind of lizard, but walked upright, with containers on their back. One turned. He had no eyes. I did not scream when I saw these things, but the horror of the images instilled would not go away. Even in the bright light of day, I could still be struck with terror by the very thought of the frogmen in the cave. And now my thoughts were turning me into one of them. My wheezing became theirs, my footsteps theirs, my arms theirs, and closing my eyes, it was those eyeless faces of theirs I saw before me. The cave, the black water, the line of frogmen with lamps in their hands. It became so bad that opening my eyes again did not help, even though I could see I was in my room, surrounded by familiar objects. The terror did not release its grip. I hardly dared blink for fear that something might happen. Stiffly, I sat down on the bed, reached for my satchel without looking at it, glanced at the school timetable, found Wednesday, read what it said, math, orientation, music, lifted the satchel onto my lap and mechanically flipped through the books inside. This done, I took the open book from the pillow, sat against the wall, and began to read. The seconds between looking up soon became minutes, and when Dad shouted it was time for supper, 9 o'clock on the dot, it was not horror that had me in its thrall, but the book. Tearing myself away from it was quite an effort as well. We were not allowed to cut bread ourselves, nor were we allowed to use the stove, so it was always either Mom or Dad who made supper. If Mom was on the evening shift, Dad did everything. When we came into the kitchen, there were 2 glasses of milk and 2 plates, each with 4 slices of bread plus toppings, waiting for us. As a rule, he had prepared the food beforehand and then kept it in the fridge, and the fact that it was cold made it difficult to swallow, even when I liked the toppings he had chosen. If Mom was at home, there was a selection of meats, cheeses, jars on the table, either hers or ours, and this small touch, which allowed us to choose what would be on the table or on our sandwiches. In addition to the bread being at room temperature, this was sufficient to engender a sense of freedom in us. If we could open the cupboard, take the plates, which always made a bit of a clatter when they knocked against one another, and laid them on the table. If we could open the cutlery drawer, which always rattled, and place the knives beside our plates. If we could set out the glasses, open the fridge, take the milk, and pour it. Then you could be sure we would open our mouths and speak. One thing naturally led to another when we had supper with Mom. We chatted away about anything that occurred to us. She was interested in what we had to say, and if we spilt a few drops of milk or forgot our manners and put the used tea bag on the tablecloth, for she made us tea as well. It was no huge drama. But if it was our participation in the meal that opened this sluice gate of freedom, it was the extent of my father's presence that regulated its impact. If he was outside the house or down in his study, we chatted as loudly and freely with many gestures as we liked. If he was on his way up the stairs, we automatically lowered our voices and changed the topic of conversation in case we were talking about something we assumed he might consider unseemly. If he came into the kitchen, we stopped altogether. Sat there as stiff as pokers, to all outward appearances sunk in concentration on the food. On the other hand, if he retired to the living room, we continued to chat, but more warily and more subdued. That evening, the plates with the 4 prepared slices awaited us as we entered the kitchen. 1 with brown goat's cheese, 1 with ordinary cheese, 1 with sardines and tomato sauce, and 1 with clove cheese. I didn't like sardines and ate that slice first. I couldn't stand fish. Boiled cod, which we had at least once a week, made me feel nauseous, as did the steam from the pan in which it was cooked, its taste and consistency. I felt the same about boiled pollock, boiled coley, boiled haddock, boiled flounder, boiled mackerel, and boiled rosefish. With sardines, it wasn't the taste that was the worst part. I could swallow the tomato sauce by imagining it was ketchup. It was the consistency, and above all, the small, slippery tails. They were disgusting. To minimize contact with them, I generally bit them off, put them to the side of my plate, nudged some sauce toward the crust, and buried the tails in the middle, then folded the bread over. In this way, I was able to chew a couple of times without ever coming into contact with the tails, and then wash the whole thing down with milk. If Dad was not there, as was the case this evening, it was possible, of course, to stuff the tiny tails in my trouser pocket. Yngwie would frown and shake his head when I did that. Then he smiled. I returned the smile. In the living room, Dad stirred in his chair. There was the faint rustle of a box of matches, followed by the brief rasp of the sulfur head across the rough surface, and the crackle as it burst into flame, which seemed to merge into the subsequent silence. When the smell of the cigarette seeped into the kitchen a few seconds later, Yngwie bent forward and opened the windows as quietly as he could. The sounds that drifted in from the darkness outside transformed the whole atmosphere of the kitchen. All of a sudden, it was part of the country outside. It's like we're sitting on a shelf, I thought. The thought caused the hairs on my forearm to stand on end. The wind rose with a sough through the forest and swept over the rustling branches and trees in the garden below. From the intersection came the sound of children still crouched over their bikes, chatting. On the hill up to the bridge, a motorbike changed gear, and far off, as if above all else, was the drone of a boat on its way into the fjord. Of course, he had heard me. My feet running on the shingle. Want to swap? Yngvi mumbled, pointing to the clove cheese. All right, I said. Elated to have solved the riddle, I washed down the last bite of the sardine sandwich with a tiny sip of milk, and started on the slice Yngvi had put on my plate. The trick was to eke out the milk, because if you came to the last and there was none left, it was almost impossible to swallow. Best of all, of course, was to save a drop until everything was eaten. The milk never tasted as good then, and when it no longer had to fulfill a function, it ran down your throat in its own right, pure and uncontaminated, but unfortunately, it was rare for me to manage this. The needs of the moment always trumped promises of the future, however enticing the latter. But Yngvi did manage it. He was a past master at economizing. Up at Prestbachmo's, there is a click of boot heels on the doorstep. Then three short cries cut through the night. Gear! 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 The response came from John Beck's drive after such a long time that everyone who heard concluded that he had been considering it. Right, he shouted. Straight after, there is the sound of his running feet. As they approached Gustavin's wall, Dad got up in the living room. Something about the way he crossed the floor made me duck my head. Yngvi ducked too. Dad came into the kitchen, walked over to the counter, leaned forward without a word, and closed the window with a bang. We keep the window closed at night, he said. Yngvi nodded. Dad looked at us. Eat up now, he said. Not until he was back in the living room did I meet Yngvi's glance. I whispered. Ha ha, he whispered back. He meant you as well. He was two slices ahead of me and was soon able to leave the table and slip into his room, leaving me to chew for a few more minutes. I had been planning to see my father after supper and tell him they would probably be showing the story with the face in the sea in the late night news, but under the circumstances, it was probably best to ditch that plan. Or was it? I decided to play it by ear. After leaving the kitchen, I usually stuck my head into the living room to say goodnight. If his voice was neutral, or if luck was with me, friendly even, I would mention it. Otherwise not. Unfortunately, he had chosen to sit on the sofa at the back of the room, and not in one of the two leather chairs in front of the television, as was his wont. To gain eye contact, I could not just poke my head in the door and say goodnight en passant, as it were, which I could have done if he had been sitting in one of the leather chairs, but would have had to take several steps into the room. That would obviously make him aware that I was after something, and that would defeat the whole purpose of playing things by ear. Whatever tone he replied in, I would have to come clean. It wasn't until I was out of the kitchen that I realized this and was caught in two minds. If I came to a halt all of a sudden, I had no choice, for of course he heard me pause, and that was bound to have made him aware I wanted something from him. So I took the four steps to enter his field of vision. He was sitting with his legs crossed, his elbows on the back of the sofa, head reclining, resting on his interlaced fingers. His gaze, which had been focused on the ceiling, directed itself at me. Good night, Dad, I said. Good night, he said. I'm sure they'll be showing it again on the news, I said. Just thought I'd tell you, so that you and Mom can see it. Showing what? The face, I said. The face? I must have been standing there with my mouth agape because he suddenly dropped his jaw and gawked in a way I understood was supposed to be an imitation of me. The one I told you about, I said. He closed his mouth and sat up straight without averting his eyes. Now, let's not be hearing any more about that face, he said. All right, I said. As I made my way down the corridor, I could feel his glare relinquishing its hold on me. I brushed my teeth, undressed, got into pajamas, switched on the lamp above my bed, turned on the main light, settled down, and started reading. I was only allowed to read for half an hour until 10 o'clock, but usually read until Mom came home at around 10:30. Tonight was no exception. When I heard the beetle coming up the hill from the main road, I put the book on the floor, switched off the light, and lay in the dark listening for her, the car door slamming, the crunch across the gravel, the front door opening, her coat and scarf being removed, the footsteps up the stairs. The house seemed different then, when she was in it, and the strange thing was that I could feel it. If, for example, I had gone to sleep before she returned and I awoke in the middle of the night, I could sense she was there. Something in the atmosphere had changed without my being able to put my finger on quite what it was, except to say that it had a reassuring effect. The same applied to those occasions when she had come home earlier than expected while I was out. The moment I set foot in the hall, I knew she was home. Of course, I would have liked to speak with her. She, of all people, would have understood the face business, but it did not seem like a burning necessity. The important thing was that she was here. I heard her deposit her keys on the telephone table as she came up the stairs, open the sliding door, say something to Dad, and close it behind her. Now and then, especially on evening shifts on the weekend, he would cook a meal for her when she arrived. Then they might play records. Once in a while, there is an empty bottle of wine on the counter, always the same label, a run-of-the-mill red, and on rare occasions, beer. Again, the same Vinopolit label, two or three bottles of pills from the Irondale Brewery, the brown 0.7-liter one with the yellow sailing ship logo. But not tonight. And I was glad. If they ate together, they did not watch television, and they would have to if I was to accomplish my plan, which was as simple as it was bold. At a few seconds to 11, I would sneak out of bed, tiptoe along the landings, open the sliding door a fraction, and watch the late news from there. I had never done anything like this before, nor even contemplated it. If I wasn't allowed to do something, I didn't do it, ever. Not once, not if my father had said no. Not knowingly, at any rate. But this was different, since it was not about me, but about them. After all, I had seen the image of the face in the sea and did not need to see it again. I just wanted to find out if they could see what I had seen. Such were my thoughts as I lay in the dark following the green hands of my alarm clock. When it was as quiet as it was now, I could hear cars driving past on the main road below. An acoustic racetrack that started as they came over the ridge by BMAX, the new supermarket, and continued down the cutting by Holthead, past the road to Gamle Terbakken, and up the hall to the bridge, where it finished as quietly as it had begun a half minute earlier. At 9:59, the door of the house across the road opened. I knelt up in bed and peered out the window. It was Fru Gustafsson. She was walking across the drive with a garbage bag in her hand. I only realized how rare a sight this was when I saw her. Fru Gustafsson hardly ever showed herself outside. Either she was seen indoors or in the passenger seat of their blue Ford Taunus. But even though I knew that, the thought had never struck me before. But now, as she stood by the garbage can, removing the lid, chucking the bag in, and closing the lid, all with the somewhat lazy grace that so many fat women possess, it did. She was never outdoors. The street lamp beyond our hedge cast its light over her, but unlike the objects she was surrounded by, the garbage can, the white walls of the trailer, the paving slabs, the pavement, which all reflected the cold, sharp light, her figure seemed to modulate and absorb it. Her bare arms gave off a matte gleam. The material of her white sweater shimmered, her mass of grayish-brown hair appeared almost golden. For a while, she stood looking around, first over at Prestbachmo's, then up at the Hansons, then down at the forest across the road. A cat strutted down towards her, stopped and watched her for a moment. She ran one hand up her arm a few times, Then she turned and went inside. I glanced at the clock again, 4 minutes to 11. I shivered and wondered briefly whether I should put on a sweater, but concluded that would make everything seem too calculated if I was caught, and it was not going to take very long. I crept warily to the door and pressed my ear against it. The only real element of risk was that the toilet was on this side of the sliding door. Once there, I would be able to keep an eye on them and have a chance to retreat if they should get up. But if the sliding door was closed and they came toward me, I wouldn't know until it was too late. But in that case, I could pretend I was going to the toilet. Pleased with the solution, I cautiously opened the door and stepped into the passage. Everything was quiet. I tiptoed along the landing, felt the dry wall-to-wall carpeting against my sweaty soles, stopped by the sliding door, heard nothing, pulled it open a fraction, and peered through the crack. The television was on in the corner. The two leather chairs were empty. So they were on the sofa, both of them. Perfect. Then the globe with the end sign whirled around on the screen. I prayed to God they would show the same news report so that Mom and Dad could see what I saw. The newscasters started the program by talking about the missing fishing boat, and my heart was pounding in my chest. But the report they showed was different. Instead of pictures of a calm sea, a local police officer was being interviewed on a quay, followed by a woman with a small child in her arms. Then the reporter himself spoke against a background of billowing waves. After the item was over, there was the sound of my father's voice and laughter. The shame that suffused my body was so strong, I was unable to think. My innards seemed to blanch. The force of the sudden shame was the sole feeling from my childhood that could measure in intensity against that of terror, next to sudden fury, of course, and common to all three, was the sense that I, myself, was being erased. All that mattered was precisely that feeling. So, as I turned and went back to my room, I noticed nothing. I know that the window in the stairwell must have been dark, that the hall was reflected in it. I know that the door to Yngwie's bedroom must have been closed, the same as the one to my parents' bedroom and to the bathroom. I know that Mom's bunch of keys must have been splayed out on the telephone table, like some mythical beast at rest, with its head of leather and myriad metal legs. I know that the knee-high ceramic vase of dried flowers and straw must have been on the floor next to it, unreconciled as it were with the synthetic material of the wall-to-wall carpet. But I saw nothing, heard nothing, thought nothing. I went into my room, lay down on my bed, and switched off the light. And when the darkness closed itself around me, I took such a deep breath that it quivered, while the muscles in my stomach tightened and forced out whimpering noises that were so loud I had to direct them into the soft and soon very wet pillow. It helped, in much the same way that vomiting helps when you are nauseous. Long after the tears had stopped coming, I lay sobbing. That had a soothing effect. When it, too, had worn itself out, I lay on my stomach, rested my head against my arm, and closed my eyes to sleep.